ladies and gentlemen. Welcome again to another edition of Liberty Unbridled. I'm your host, Ken Molman. This is the My View Matters Radio Network. Well, it's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and we have a handful of things to tackle tonight. If you'd like to call in tonight, the number here is area code 858-683-1326. Again, 858-683-1326. And the chat room is open. I don't really check it, but if you happen to jump in there, I do at times check it during the break. So to get things started tonight, always on a light note, we turn to the political rhetoric generator, which randomly generates us some wonderful, silly political rhetoric. Tonight's random rhetoric is, unlike myself, my opponent wants an America where communists and corrupt politicians can undermine our innocent babies' smiles. I love the generator. Anyhow, just a few stories here. One of the things that kind of a growing trend are these private security firms doing police activities in neighborhoods. And there's quite a bit of debate on whether or not that's a good idea. There are some folks that see private police as a sign of a fascist state. There are other folks that see private police as a sign of a libertarian state. I really think it just depends on how it's done. I think that anytime you give someone the authority to arrest or to otherwise apprehend another person, it really just depends on the limits that are placed on how that duty is carried out that make all the difference in the world. There are neighborhoods in Detroit right now that are hiring private security because the police just won't go there. They just won't go. And, you know, can you blame them? I mean, if there's a crime, if there's something going on, if there's, you know, police presence is needed for whatever reason, what do? Just call 911 and they say, sorry, too bad, and no one ever shows up and you just leave it be? Or do you go out and get, you know, build your own, buy your own police force? Also, there's a story here, and this is a few weeks old. I've been trying to get to this for a while and never had enough material to really go through all this, but another story from Houston where a Houston neighborhood started using private security, previously been asking for extra protection and paying the local sheriff's department for extra protection, and this neighborhood in turn switched out to a private security firm, and the cost of the private security firm was half as much, and based on, and I don't exactly understand what it was based on, whether it was better patrolling or whatever, maybe it was just coincidence, but crime rates fell as well. And I think that, again, you can do this the right way and you can do it the wrong way. When you have a private police force, as long as they are not being incentivized to harass people but are being paid to do a job, then I think you can have a good result out of private policing. Where the problem comes in, and we've seen examples of this in the private prison industry, where there was a judge that was convicted for intentionally sending people to longer terms than necessary and basically conspiring with a private prison to incarcerate people for longer periods of time. The state would pay the private prison to incarcerate these people, and in turn, the private prison would donate to the judge, or at least the workers at the private prison would donate to the judge. And obviously, that's an example of how that can go horribly awry, because you're creating incentives incentives that are not good, incentives that are not within the intent of the privatization movement. So, you know, when people wanted the private prisons, they didn't want people to be locked up unnecessarily for an extended period of time. That's not at all what they were seeking to do. What they were seeking to do was cut costs. But it is an important thing to note that there are unintended consequences. And if you incentivize law enforcement, any aspect thereof, whether it's the police, I should say you incentivize criminal justice, any piece of it, whether it's policing or judging or those responsible for incarceration, I think you're creating a potential issue. Because no longer does it become about justice. It becomes about profit. Now, profit is not inherently evil. But without a proper check and balance, there will be a tendency to be for those seeking profit to abuse the system. And that's what we saw with that case with the judge in the private prisons. But likewise, if you were to, let's say that each police officer got $10 for every speeding ticket they wrote. They didn't get paid for anything else, but they got $10, a bonus of $10 for every speeding ticket they wrote. What do you think most of the police would be doing? They'd suddenly turn into ticket machines. They'd be ticketing people for every little, a half mile an hour over the speed limit. Because you've created an incentive for each individual in charge of doling out law enforcement. Now, obviously, speeding is against the law. And you can argue about whether it should be or not or what the limits are or whatever. It doesn't matter. We're not discussing that piece of it. But if you create incentives, individuals will choose that incentive because they individually are getting a better deal by following the incentives. And so a private police force, if it has the wrong incentives, and because they have the authority to arrest or to otherwise detain, is asking for trouble, certainly. So if you're going to have private security, private policing, then you must be very, very careful about how you do it. There must be very strict limits on those engaged in the policing. And even in our public sector today, we have a lot of problems with perverse incentives, incentives that cause police to go out and target certain individuals. For many years in the state, there's been a contest almost, I guess it is officially, for finding people who are most likely to be drunk drivers. You get an award based on the number of drunk drivers you incarcerate. This particular incentive was at one time used to profile me. At the time, I had purchased a vehicle off of a friend of mine because I needed the drivetrain from it. The car itself looked atrocious. It had been through far too many winters with way too much salt, and the body was rusting off of the car. And I was pulled over for basically nothing, given the third degree, and every other sentence out of the officer's mouth was, "Have you been drinking tonight?" Because the vehicle fit a profile for someone who would be drinking and driving. Now, I don't drink and drive, so I had no problem in that regard. And it's funny, while I own that vehicle, I was pulled over for every little stupid thing possible while driving that vehicle. I mean, it was really amazing. I drove no different than when I drive my little Mazda normally. I was literally getting pulled over every two or three times I actually took the car out and drove it. Even though it was legally tagged, I had insurance for it. There was no technical issues with the vehicle. It just looked like garbage. It fit a profile. And that's the real problem with all of this, whether it's public or private policing. It's the incentives. It's the incentives. Now, certainly, you can't go without any incentives, right? If there were no incentives, if you didn't have to do anything as a police officer at all, then police officers would just sit at a coffee shop or a donut shop or whatever and never do anything. They wouldn't respond to calls. If there were no consequences for them not, they wouldn't do anything. So there's going to be an incentive no matter what as far as are you doing your job. But I think that it's the metrics that matter. And in Campbell County up here, the police chief admitted in a fiscal court meeting that the county police have a quota. And in fact, they have fired people for not meeting the quota. The quota being of speeding tickets. Now, what's funny about that is supposedly, anyway, speeding tickets, the county supposedly doesn't get any of that money. It all goes downstate. I'm not sure that's entirely true, but that's what I've been told. So what is the incentive there? At this point, I'm convinced there's a quid pro quo involved with having money kicked back from Frankfurt. I don't know. I don't understand it. It doesn't make any sense at all. And I've talked to a number of people in law enforcement, not in Campbell County, but throughout the state and elsewhere, and they agree there has to be some sort of incentive there, because otherwise it makes no sense. Because there are a heck of a lot more important things going on in northern Kentucky and throughout the state of Kentucky than catching people speeding 5 or 10 miles an hour over the limit on the highway. In case you haven't heard, there's a heroin epidemic. So the question is, why? What are the incentives? And I don't know the answers to that. But there is, and I think whether private or public, there's also a problem of who is incentivized to get into law enforcement at all. I think that's a big problem. There are people who are police officers who are in it for the right reasons. People who really do believe in doing the right thing, that they are being public servants. They exist. I've met them. I'm not making that up. Unfortunately, many that you run into are the ones that are more about the power of having a gun and a badge. And I say that the ones you run into because they're more likely to mess with people because they have a gun and a badge and they want to use it. Whereas those who are content to leave people alone and do other things like respond to actual calls and, investigate robberies and, real crimes are less likely to be the guys out on the highway harassing you for doing 6 miles an hour over the speed limit. So the point is that there's a right way and a wrong way to do law enforcement. And I don't even know that this is a private versus public argument. You often hear this, but I don't think that it's public versus private. It's are they doing the right thing and are they doing it for the right reasons? Right before the show tonight, I got a story about the police chief in Salt Lake City. And he apparently takes a very wise approach. His approach is to try to de-escalate potentially bad situations. Instead of confronting, and they used the example in the story of the Occupy protesters, instead of coming out in riot gear and tossing tear gas and, batons and shields and all that stuff, the chief went out and talked to the protesters and said, hey, guys, we've had some problems. We just need you guys to go home at night. And, here's the thing. We'll even help you pack up for the night. If there's some of you who want to be arrested just for the show of it or whatever, let us know. We'll make sure to do it respectfully. We'll make sure it's in front of the camera so you get your 5 minutes of fame. We'll arrest you. That's what you really want. But everybody else, you know, we ask that you leave peacefully. And sure enough, of the, according to the story here, 200 people that were there, almost all of them went home peacefully at night. And there were a handful that chose to be arrested. They were arrested peacefully. Oh, it's important to mention that when the police came that night, they didn't come in riot gear. They didn't come with shields, batons, all that stuff. They just came in their normal uniform. Most of them went peacefully. Actually, all of them went peacefully. The few that chose to be arrested were arrested. That was that. And I think that that's an important thing to note, because I think there's a lot of, I don't think it's intentional, but I think that it's a negligence thing, that oftentimes the police can escalate things unnecessarily. I don't know if you all saw the story floating around Facebook about the father that called the police on his son. The son had gotten into an argument with the father because the father wouldn't go buy a pack of cigarettes for the son. The son jumped in the father's truck and left and was heading to the store to buy cigarettes and come back. The father, to teach the son a lesson, called the police. Well, the police ended up shooting the kid dead. Shot him dead. Closer to home, a friend of mine was the victim of a hit and run, didn't know it, left the scene, right? She was inside, somebody bumped her car, the person came back in, and while they were trying to find her, she left, and then they would, oh my gosh, and so this woman who had hit my friend was trying to do the right thing and asked a firefighter friend to call the, get a hold of a policeman friend, and they tried to put out try to figure out who this was, my friend. Well, somehow through the layers of communication, it turned from, hey, this person who hit my friend is trying to find them, to, hey, my friend was involved in a hit and run and she's avoiding the police or can't be found. Somehow it got turned into that. And it was just a comedy of errors. Hilarious how it happened. And in the end, as they're getting ready to arrest my friend, they get a hold of the other person and are like, oh, oops, sorry, our bad. And the point is that there's a way to escalate situations and a way to de-escalate situations. And oftentimes, the approach by law enforcement escalates situations, whether intentional or not. That's what creates the danger. That's what creates the situation, 99 times out of 100. Yeah, there are bad people out there that are going to escalate situations no matter what. I'm not denying that. But it certainly shouldn't be the police that are causing the escalation of the situation, right? That's not going to work out well. And I think that there are better ways to do it. I think there are, whether it's public or private policing, it has to do with the way it's done. That's the point. It's how is it done. That's what's important, not whether it's public or private, honestly. Not from an everyday individual basis. Now, public or private, you can get into all kinds of other arguments about pensions and benefits and blah, 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 blah. Don't care. That's not what we're here to talk about. But when it comes down to it, as far as doing the job, it's all about incentives and training. And I think that if we take away the incentives that cause people to act poorly, and we take away, or rather we give people the training to de-escalate situations rather than resorting to, oh, well, I don't like how this is going, so I'm going to pull my gun and point it at you and tell you to do stuff and or pull the mace and try to spray you down or whatever. I think you would have a much safer environment for both the officers and the people involved. Hey, you know, people get emotional. People make rash decisions when they're emotional. Making them more irrational, making them more emotional is not going to solve that problem. The key is to tone it down, to diffuse a situation like this chief did in Salt Lake City. He went out to angry people that are protesting and spending the night on public property. They're that upset. And was able to successfully de-escalate what could have been a much uglier situation. So that's kind of just the point on that. I didn't mean to go that long on that, and I've got a lot to cover here. Switching gears real quick, we have a handful of state house races that are shaping up for next year already. To this point, some of the more interesting ones to note, in the Louisville area in Jefferson County, you've got former gubernatorial candidate Phil Moffitt versus the former GOP chairwoman Shelley May. And that's an interesting race because the Shelley May was involved in the Red Stars down in Louisville, which we haven't done a Red Star update in a long time, so I guess this is could be considered one. She was those that are new to the show, Red Stars were given to people who had signed minor Gatewood's petitions in 2011, which simply gave us access to the ballot. It didn't promise to vote for us or anything like that. And understand that the disparity between Republican and Democratic candidates and everyone else in that statewide race was that Republicans and Democrats needed two signatures, one, two. Anybody else, Gatewood and myself, were the only two that ran, needed a minimum of 5,000 signatures. And that was the disparity that we were overcoming by getting those signatures. And a number of Tea Partiers, rightfully so, saw that that was incorrect and signed mine or Gatewood's petition. As a result, the Republican Party in particular was extraordinarily ugly about what they did. And what they did was they made it so that anyone who had signed, any Republican who had signed mine and or Gatewood's petition was given a red star on their little precinct card or whatever and prevented from assisting or participating in the elections of local county parties. And it didn't happen everywhere, but it did happen in Northern Kentucky. It did happen in Louisville. And Shelley May was the chairwoman at the time when that occurred in Louisville. And Phil Moffitt, during his campaign, had been dinged specifically for signing my petition. As a candidate, he signed my petition. And there were people even saying that that disqualified him. It, of course, didn't. It was silliness. But the point is that this is really a matchup between the establishment and the Tea Party in a house race in Louisville. And boy, is that going to be interesting to watch how that comes down. In a special election, there is a three-way race for an open seat in the 13th Senate seat. You've got, there are three guys there. I can't remember everybody. I apologize. But one of the Republican running is a guy that's within the Liberty circles. If you've been around and seen any of that, you would know him. He's Big Mike. And he is a large black gentleman who is a really good guy and talks about and does a really good job of explaining the issues and problems in the black community to people that may not understand those issues. And so if you've never met Big Mike, I really encourage you to meet Big Mike, really good guy, and really concerned about the community. And so I think that that should be a very interesting race. It's a heavily Democratic district. You've got it's a three-way, so it's a Democrat, an Independent, and a Republican in that race. And I can't remember when that race, let's see what the story says. It's in December. December 10th is when the election will occur. So it'll be very interesting. The Independent is a former Democrat. So you have a Democrat, a former Democrat, and a Republican running in that race. So that'll be interesting to watch. In Northern Kentucky, all of the judge execs are getting primaried and also have people stepping up to run as, it's mainly primaries at the moment. In Campbell, Kenton, and Boone, all three are Republicans and all three have challengers in the primary, and that should be interesting to see how that kind of plays out. The establishment up here is behind two of the three judge execs, and it'll be kind of interesting to see how that plays out. All right, so What time is it? Boy, you know what? We're going to take a quick break here. Let me mention this real quick. The other thing, when it comes to elections, the Libertarian candidate, David Patterson, is officially kicked off his campaign this week. So his campaign, he announced his intent, oh, gosh, I don't know, 2 months ago, and we had him on the show at the time. He has since been working to get his campaign geared up, get his campaign website online, and he officially launched his campaign this week on Wednesday, which was the first day legally that he could start getting signatures for the ballot to get on the ballot. Again, he's in a situation where the Democrats and Republicans only need 2 signatures, and he will need 5,000 signatures. So if you have a problem with that and would like to assist him in getting signatures, you can go out to his website, David4Senate.com. It's David4Senate.com. David4Senate.com. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Virginia election and the fallout and all that stuff. If you haven't been following this, trust me, it's interesting. And then if we have the time for it, we've got Obamacare. I mean, it just keeps getting uglier and uglier over there. Stay tuned, folks. We'll be back here in just a few moments. You're listening to Liberty Unbridled and the My View Matters Radio Network.
Pounding away. What? first impressions aren't the most important thing. They're the only thing. At Ernie's Print Shop, we'll produce what you need to represent your company professionally. Right now, you can get 1,000 full-color business cards, 1,000 4x6 postcards, or a 3x5 banner for just $60. You choose. Check us out at erniesprintshop.com. Ernie's Print Shop. Over 50 years, one source, one solution. erniesprintshop.com. 502-969-8585.
Being a victim of crime is no joke, but you do have options that can help you avoid becoming a victim. I'm Ed Springsteen of the My View Matters radio show, and on behalf of myself and co-host Ed Martin, I urge each of you to help us fight against crime. You can do your part by calling Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE. Since 1982, Crime Stoppers has helped get over 23,000 criminals off the street with your help. Working together, we can make a difference to take our streets back. Please call Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE, or you can visit them online at www.582clue.com. Remember, Crime Stoppers always offers up to a $1,000 reward. Get involved and help make a positive change in your neighborhood. Thanks.
Advertisers, here's a great way to reach a quality audience. Get heard on My View Matters and make some noise in the marketplace.
Email MyViewMatters at AOL.com for advertising opportunities. Make a sound investment.
All right, folks, and we're back. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters radio network. Diving into the Virginia governor's race, you might be wondering, well, what's the big deal about the Virginia governor's race if you haven't been following this at all? Well, in the Virginia governor's race, for the first time in many years, there was a third person besides a Democrat or a Republican on the ballot, and it was a Libertarian, Robert Sarvis. Sarvis was running a moderate Libertarian campaign, was focused on things we could do today, something I've always encouraged our candidates to focus on, is not some sort of pie-in-the-sky distant future, but what we can do today to make things better and move things in a liberty direction. And in the race, it was pretty interesting. Towards the end, the Libertarian candidate was reaching 12 and 13% in some polls. Actually, in most polls, he was above 10. And it was an interesting dynamic and interesting race to watch. I watched the race for about 4 months and had been running numbers on it. The reason it was important for the Libertarian Party in Virginia was that if Tain 10%, if Sarvis had gotten 10%, he would have been able to grant the Libertarian Party ballot access in Virginia for some number of years. And it was some, I can't tell if it was 4 or 8 years, I don't know which, but it would have given them ballot access for quite some time. And Sarvis did a pretty good job considering that he was excluded from all three televised debates and that he was woefully underfunded, as usual. There was a big controversy, though, right at the end. And at the end of the race, there were a number of people that came out and started bashing the Libertarian candidate, Sarvis, because he was slated to get, based on my math and based on my study of polls, he was going to get somewhere in the somewhere over 9% of the vote on election day. And unfortunately, Rand Paul got involved in the race and came out for the Republican, and a number of folks came out. And not only did they do that, but there was also a number of articles, a number of hit pieces that came out against the Libertarian candidate. And, of course, having far fewer dollars to throw around and not being used to being the victim of a hit piece, typically Libertarians are ignored rather than the victims of hit pieces, they were not very quick to react to a lot of it. And, of course, it was that last-minute thing, right? This all kind of came up the weekend before the election, so 3 or 4 days before the election, and it was pretty interesting to see what came of this. So the final results in Virginia was that the Democrats won with 47.74%, and the Republican came in second with 45.23%, so a difference of just over 2.5%, right, 2.5%. The Libertarian candidate ended up with 6.52%. So more than 2.5 times the vote tally of the difference between the Democrat and the Republican. So this led a lot of Republicans to claim that Sarvis was stealing their votes. He's taking our votes. Oh, my gosh, those votes belong to us. But did they? Additionally, at the same time that was all going on, there were a lot of claims that Sarvis, the Libertarian candidate, wasn't Libertarian at all. Oh, my gosh, he's not a Libertarian. And look at that. I mean, no. In one interview, he said he wasn't into Austrian economics. Oh, my gosh, he must not be a Libertarian. Well, within Libertarianism, there's actually two or three different schools of economics that they argue amongst themselves, which is better. Austrian is one. The point is that he's actually more of a Hayekian and whatever. The point is there were a lot of smears that came out right at the end. The disappointing thing was who was doing it. You know, in the end, it was an election, right? And we should expect that if you're doing well, you're going to get hit. And that's fine. But there's still, and it's funny, because people are so gullible to listen to those last-minute hit pieces, to think that there's credibility or legitimacy to something that comes out the last minute. I mean, are people really not paying that close of attention to see the pattern that this happens every freaking election? Really? It was just kind of interesting because the Republicans decided they would go after Sarvis to try to get a good bit of his vote to try to push them over the top. Now, make no mistake, it did in part work. Based on the polling that I was seeing, the Democrat would have still won, and he should have got 74 point something, or not 74, excuse me, 47 point something percent. The Republican was slated to get 43 point something percent, and Sarvis was slated to get about 9-point-something percent. And, you know, the somethings are all a little fuzzy when you can't predict it down that far. But based on the math that I have come up with in general in watching elections over the past decade or so, that's what should have come out of it. What was shown on election night was that Sarvis did not get 9%. And in fact, he got 2.5% less than what I had predicted based on the math applied from other races around the country and here in Kentucky. And in turn, the Republican gained about 2.5%. So it looks like the 2.5%, the last minute hit parade, did take 2.5% off of the Libertarian and give it to the Republican. But that was still not enough. And it never could have been enough, in fact. There were polls that were showing that where the Libertarian candidate was getting their votes. And he was getting more votes from otherwise Democrat voters than from otherwise Republican voters. And that's of the people who would have voted anyway. And there was a good number of people who wouldn't have voted anyway. The polls were showing that ahead of time. And in the end, what the exit polls actually showed was that 2-1, let's rewind so the math makes sense. 50% of the people who voted in the election for Sarvis would not have otherwise voted. Right? So we take half of that 6.5 and we throw them right out the window. Right? So now we're down to 3.25. Of the remaining, and we're going to make it easier, I'm going to say 3.3 because that makes it easier on math. So of the remaining 3.3%, 2.2 of the 3.3 were otherwise Democratic voters. 1.1 were otherwise Republican voters. Well, if you take that 1.1 and you add it on to the Republican, he still loses, and he still loses by over a percentage of 1.4-ish. He still loses. He just doesn't lose as bad. And in fact, there's been a number of news articles that have said, hey, if Sarvis hadn't been in the race, the margin would have been even greater. The Democrat would have been over 50%. And the exit polls show that. Both CNN and ABC ran exit polls, and they showed the exact same thing. There's a great article from a blog or a publication called The Federalist that dug in really, 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 really deep into the numbers, precinct by precinct, county by county, and sure enough, he found the same thing, that it all comes out of wash in the end, that it would not have changed the outcome at all had Sarvis not been in the race. If you look at the demographics of who voted for Sarvis, it was the 18 to 35 demographic primarily. And that is a demographic that normally, if they vote, in the past voted for Obama. So it should really be no surprise that the votes that Sarvis did get were not, he didn't cause the election to be won by the Democrats. And that was the big thing the Republicans have been putting out there. And in fact, they put it out there strong enough that there are still people repeating this talking point, even though there is math, factual numbers out there to genuinely and definitively reject that notion. And the big one that's going around is, and it's funny because the amount changes and all this, the big one is that there was an Obama bundler, that the Democrats paid the guy to run as a libertarian, as a hired hitter to screw up the election, and that, you know, there was a big Democrat bundler, Obama bundler, that donated $150,000 of the $200,000 that Sarvis raised and blah, blah, blah. And boy, is that way, way off. To rewind and explain this just so everyone understands it, guy out in Texas who's a software guy, millionaire, at one time contacted one of the guys in the Libertarian Party who's known as one of the more effective folks out there as campaign managers and strategists go. He's actually our executive director of the National Party now. Contacted him and said, hey, what would the Libertarian Party be able to do with $1 million? Now, he never did give $1 million, but over time, he's given approximately $300,000 to the Libertarian Party since 2008. What he was able to do with that money, he gave $150,000 this year, and he gave it to a PAC, right? And the PAC is known as the Libertarian Booster PAC. Well, what is the Libertarian Booster PAC? The Libertarian Booster PAC focuses on paying for ballot access. Ballot access, as I mentioned earlier, that way in many states, not just Kentucky, is inequitable. If you are a Republican or a Democrat, it is always, almost always, easier to get on the ballot than if you're anything else, independent, libertarian, green, constitution, whatever you want to be. And the Libertarian Booster PAC injects money for libertarian candidates to overcome those stupid artificial barriers to entry for libertarian candidates to compete. So what they actually gave, the Libertarian Booster PAC, collected $150,000 from a guy whose wife was an Obama bundler, but he was not, who did give $5,000. He maxed out to Obama in 2011. He did. But his wife was the bundler. This guy personally gives more than to Democrats. So what that means, right, to all of you Republicans who claim that, well, you know, I think the best way to go is through the Republican Party, not the Libertarian Party. He's one of those, kind of, except he's on the other end. He thinks that going through the Democratic Party might be more effective than going through the Libertarian Party. And that's why he and his wife do give to Democrats. But it's a pretty simple thing to figure out there, right? If he's giving more money, if he personally is giving more money to Libertarians than to Democrats, then he is on the left side, right? And a lot of Libertarians, especially those working within the Republican Party, don't understand that. But no, we are, as people are apt to say, the best of the Democrats and the best of the Republicans. And so this guy in particular, based on things I've seen, his focus is on civil rights. And we are the best on civil rights. And so it makes sense that he would give more to us than to Democrats who are so-so on civil rights and lately have not been good at all. So he gave $150,000, but there were other people that gave to this PAC too. Not as much. One person gave, I think, $75,000, and then another person gave $4,000, and then from there, I don't think they had to report anything. And they only, I mean, it wasn't like this was some hidden thing. It was openly reported, complying with election finance rules. It was reported. I mean, otherwise, that's how else would they have found the information? It was open to the public. There was nothing sneaky or hidden about it. They only, that PAC, gave $11,000 to the Sarvis campaign for ballot access only, and gave another $9,000 to other down-ticket Libertarian candidates, totaling about $20,000 that the PAC gave to various Libertarian candidates in Virginia just for ballot access, just to level the playing field between Democrats and Republicans and Libertarians. Now, if you want to cry about somebody giving money to level the playing field so that all the candidates start out equal, well, boo-hoo, cry me a river, because those rules are wrong, improper to treat candidates differently because of their party affiliation. It's just wrong. I mean, I'm sure Democrats would like to put restrictions on Republicans and vice versa to make it so that the other side couldn't get on the ballot as easy. Yeah, I'm sure they would. It's wrong. And so that's all that PAC did. They gave the money to help the guy get on the ballot. And it wasn't that much in the grand scheme of things. The candidate, Sarvis, raised $200,000 total, of which the $11,000 for ballot access was from that PAC, but the other $189,000 came from other sources. And there were some Republicans in that list and Democrats in that list, a lot of Libertarians in that list. It's just the way it is. Politics is politics. Money comes from somewhere. I mean, it wasn't like he was accepting money from the Nazis or anything. And so after all of that, on top of that, they were trying to say he wasn't a Libertarian. And one of the things they were talking about was this mileage tax. And the mileage tax is an interesting concept, and it's one, it's kind of a modernized version of tolling. And this is something that has been kicked around in Libertarian communities for 40 years or better about how to pay for roads, because the favorite thing for the opposition to Libertarians to complain about is, well, who's going to build the roads? And we laugh at that anymore because it is a really silly argument. It's like, you know, wait a second, there were roads before the government owned them, but okay, whatever. The point is that there is a big discussion in the intellectual side of the Libertarian movement on how do you pay for roads, whether they're public or private, how do you pay for roads? And, you know, I personally like the fuel tax. I think the fuel tax applied appropriately, and if the monies were set aside, is the proper way to fund keeping the highway system going. I think that's smart. I think it's right to do. Unfortunately, as we move towards alternate powered vehicles, you know, whether they're electric cars or battery-powered or solar or whatever they are, as more and more of those get on the road, they're not paying the fuel tax. So eventually there's going to have to be a new mechanism to pay for the roads, pay for what you use. Or in Libertarian speak, pays the fool. Which, by the way, for those that don't know, stands for there ain't no such thing as a free lunch. There has to be a way to pay for the roads, whether they're public or private. And so people have suggested the supposed black box tax, which actually what it does is keeps track. There's a couple different ways to do it. One mechanism is by GPS, which I think is a horrible idea because that will be a huge violation of privacy for the state to be able to know where you've been. Another one just keeps track of raw mileage driven. I think that's a little less invasive. I personally like the idea of being able to pay toll booths or do whatever. I don't know. I don't have the answers on it. That's why I like the fuel tax. It's completely anonymous. But it's not going to work long term. So what do? I don't know. And that's what the candidate said. You know, he's open to the idea of considering a supposed black box or mileage tax, as it's known. But he didn't say he was for it. He didn't say he was strongly for it. And for the same reasons that I brought up is why he's considering it, which is we got to pay for the road somehow. I don't know. I'm open to suggestions. But that was one of the things that were hit. He was hit really, really hard on it. And there were people that I argued with on this, and they're like, well, you know, we should just use sales tax. Well, that's kind of what the fuel tax is, okay. But that's not going to work in the long term. Well, just general sales tax. Oh, so because I went to the store and bought a boat, I'm using part of the proceeds of the sales tax of a boat to build roads? Huh? Or because I bought a house, I'm helping pay the roads? Or because I, you know, bought a candy bar, I'm helping to pay for the roads? I mean, that doesn't make sense. That skews the market as far as what funds are allocated for what, because now it's not a usage tax anymore. It's just a general tax. Hell, why not just advocate it comes out of income tax then? Because that's the same damn thing. What's the difference if you're using it that way? I don't have the answer on that, but to bash Sarvis for porting or trying to figure out something, it was bad. You know, I mean, that was not the right thing to do, and they unfortunately drug Ron Paul out and had him hit all these GOP talking points as well. And I do think that that did depress Sarvis's result. Like I said, he was slated to get low nines in the polling, and he got 6.5. So he took about 2.5 probably off of Sarvis, put it on to the Republican, and it still didn't matter. But what it did do was cause a division in the Liberty community, especially in Virginia. Oh, boy. And for what? There were a lot of people saying that this Virginia GOPer was the most libertarian governor there be. Oh, my gosh, he's so libertarian. Yeah, he's so libertarian that he's against gay rights. He's for protecting the traditional definition of marriage, which, again, we're against state marriage at all. He also was arguing, and that's the thing that's so stupid, arguing to keep the anti-sodomy laws on the books. And that was the thing the Democrats were able to successfully hang around this guy and hang him. I mean, understand, throughout the polling, the Republican never got anything other than high 30 or low 40 percentage in the polling. And the Democrat, he got between low 40s and mid 40s. And right before the Obamacare thing blew up, he hit 50%. And it's only because of Obamacare did the race even start to shrink up. The GOP guy didn't go up in the polls. The Democrat went down. But the 3% that came off the Democrat didn't go to the Republican. It went to the Libertarian. And I think that's what upset these GOPers, because they have the mindset of the lesser of two evils. So if it comes off of him, it should go to me. But these guys should know better, because part of the tactic, and they knew this walking in, and I heard a lot of this, that depending on turnout would determine the race in a large part, that low turnout helps Republicans and high turnout helps Democrats, which I think is kind of interesting. The point is that, again, 3% or more of the people who voted that ended up with Sarvis wouldn't have voted at all. Was that the 3% that came off McAuliffe, the Democrat? I don't know. But mathematically, it was so funny. The talking points, one, they were like, he's not even a real libertarian. And then at the same time, they're saying he's splitting the vote because he's a libertarian. And it was like, wait a second, how can you legitimately with a straight face say both talking points at the same time? Because they're counterintuitive. They're both the opposite of one another. That doesn't make any sense. And of course, most troubling of all is the idea of stealing or taking votes. And folks, I just want to reiterate this. Votes belong to the people who cast them. They do not belong to any party. They do not belong to any candidate. Votes belong to the individuals who cast them. And once they are cast, they are counted. And the only way votes can be stolen or taken is if someone, while counting the votes, changes that count. That is how votes are stolen. That's how votes are taken, is if there is corruption in the counting process, not in the way that they are cast. And that's a really important thing to note, because you'll hear this all the time. People will say, oh, this guy took this guy's vote. We still hear that Perot caused Bush to lose in 1992 and caused Dole to lose in 1996. Absolutely untrue. If you go back and look at the math, Perot made Bush win a few states and lose a few states in 92. And in the end, yeah, it hurt Bush a little more than it hurt Clinton, right? Because Bush ended up losing five extra electoral votes that otherwise would have been his. Instead, they went to Clinton. But the electoral votes are what matter. And in the end, five electoral votes would not have changed the outcome of the 92 election. In 96, you had two states flip-flop again. It was a very minimal thing. The reality is, hey, read my lips. You break a campaign promise, you're going to lose. Especially a big one that is the cornerstone of your campaign. In 96, you know, if you have a candidate that refers to himself in the third person and says their name like six times in the same sentence, they're going to lose. Because that was horrible. And I was one of the people. 96 was my first presidential election. I wanted to vote for Perot so bad. And I was convinced not to do it. And I went in, and I voted for Dole. And as soon as I hit the vote button, big green vote button, I regretted it. And that's what made me really start to reconsider everything. What made me start to reconsider how I was voting, who I was supporting, why, what was my core philosophy, what did I really believe? You know, I'm 19, 20 years old at the time. What did I really believe? And it sent me down this journey of self-exploration that led me to where I am now. So in many ways, I thank the Republican Party and Bob Dole and the ding-dongs that pressured me into voting for his ding-dong butt, because he was horrible. Bob Dole says Bob Dole should be Bob Dole, Bob Dole, Bob Dole. I hope that others, the reality is, voting third party, I've done it every election since 2000. I have never regretted it, ever. I always feel good about my vote. I never have to hold my nose. If I don't like a candidate, I don't vote for him. I encourage you to do the same thing. If nothing else, go to the polls, vote for no one, and hit the vote button just to send that I don't like any of these people message. I really wish we had a none of the above option. I'd love to see the results of that. But that's it, folks. We're at the end of the show. I really want you all, please, think about things. Don't believe last-minute pieces. Look at the source. Get the data. Don't parrot talking points. Don't parrot my talking points. Go look up the data, please. That's it, folks. It's the end of the show. Have a good week. Thanks for tuning in. This has been Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters Radio Network.